Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I am Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I am your host for this interview. And I'm very excited to be speaking with Robert Michael Morrissey. Dr. Morrissey is professor of history and LAS Distinguished Professorial Scholar at the University of Illinois, and is the author of the new book, People of the Ecotone: Environment and Indigenous Power at the Center of Early America, which came out with the University of Washington Press in 2022, and I'm very pleased to say, in 2023, won the Hal Rothman Prize from the Western History Association. Welcome to the New Books Network, Bob. Good to have you here, and congratulations.
Yeah, hey, thanks so much. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Why don't we begin, as we always do here on the New Books Network, by just hearing a little bit about you and who you are. I'm really interested in what your background is, and especially how you became interested in history.
Okay, yeah, well, thanks. I am a Midwesterner. I grew up outside of Chicago, and I have written now for 20 years mostly about this region and some points further west, but I kind of identify myself as a historian interested in the American West, the American frontier, environment, indigenous history. How my background plays into that, I mean, I have been interested in, I've had a sense my whole life of especially this region of the Midwest as having a kind of hidden history that I've kind of been lucky to come upon a career where I can try to investigate and bring out stories that I feel are important about this region that have been ignored or that don't make it to our consciousness of what counts as exciting American history, in part because of the this is not a particularly interesting comment, but just the sort of reputation of the Midwest as being sort of forgettable or boring or flat or homogenous or whatever. And just growing up, I was very interested in, I can remember early on, and just place names. Where'd that come from? Like, why, you know, who, for whom is that named, right? And I guess I'm talking specifically now about indigenous words that are all over the map of the Midwest, of the Great Lakes. And yeah, so that's how I became, you know, interested in history broadly, is just, I'm interested in the place where I'm from. I have storytellers in my family. My grandmothers, both in particular, were great sort of, I'd say, legendary storytellers as I was coming up. And then I also had teachers. From an early age, I was lucky to have some history teachers in particular who excited me about, you know, history as detective work. I know that's kind of a cliche, but I kind of learned early on that there was a kind of creative aspect of what history was all about, that it was something that you do, not just something that you passively kind of learn or certainly memorize. So I feel pretty lucky that that's my job now, is to try to pass on that insight to my students, and try to get them excited about that creative work. But that, you know, that's how my background kind of connects to what I'm doing, is just a sense of where I'm from. It is full of interesting stories, and I have lit upon these last many years stories of place and power that I want to kind of bring to a wider attention.
you know, ask a lot of people some question along those lines, and that's a pretty frequent answer. Is people get interested in history by wondering about the place that they find themselves, looking around them as a young person, saying, "Why is this place like this?" And hearing you say that about the Midwest, it kind of makes me realize that more people, I feel like, are asking that in a historical sense about the Midwest. I feel like there's been a lot of good, interesting work done about the Midwest in the last couple of years. I'm thinking about people like Kristen Hoganson, for instance, who I had her on to talk about her book, The Heartland, a couple of years ago, for instance. And I feel like the Midwest is sort of at this cutting edge of people asking about this sort of place.
Yeah. Well, Kristen... she's in the office next door to me. I'm super lucky to work with her, and I've learned a ton from Kristen about the Midwest, and we share a lot of interests in common, and you know, a lot of it for both of us recently has come down to sort of the environment. I mean, she's written so beautifully about, you know, about agriculture and its global dimensions in the 19th century. You know, that's not something that many, you know, that's certainly not the grand narrative of Midwestern agriculture is it, you know, as she points out, it's like, well, this is the quintessentially local place, right? This is a place that is, kind of even insular, right, in mythology or kind of in a sort of romantic trope, but she does such beautiful work to call our attention to the global dimensions of Midwestern history. It's always been, right, this very networked part of North America in the period of settler agriculture, and So she's doing really exciting work. And, you know, I think all of us doing work on this region are pretty grateful to, kind of some institutionalization of this conversation, especially by a guy called John Locke, who has written a number of really interesting books about Midwestern regionalism, right? You think about American historiography, there is this long tradition of kind of regional conversations around the U.S. South and, you know, the burden of Southern history, of course, the American West. Stephen, I don't have to tell you this, but and many of the listeners of this podcast, that there's this great tradition of historical interpretation around the distinctiveness of the American West. I feel like I'm part of that conversation as well with my work. That's how I was trained as kind of a Westerner, so to speak. But it has been interesting to watch the conversation around Midwestern regionalism take some shape. What is it? What is it about this region as opposed to, if the South is carrying the burden of Southern history and the American West is living with the legacy of conquest, quoting there C. Van Woodward and Legacy of Conquest, of course, Patricia Limerick, like, what is it about the Midwest? What's the kind of historical trope that brings together the history of this region? If I'm a part of that conversation, I think the contribution is to bring that story further back into the past. I mean, the runway of Midwestern distinctiveness is longer than sometimes we recognize in this conversation that's been going on now for the past 20 years or so.
And even here today, you know, we're having this discussion on the American West podcast channel, right? So maybe I got to start a spinoff podcast about new books in the history of the Midwest, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So I'm curious too, you know, you're talking about how environmental history has been one of the great inroads into Midwestern history, and we can define terms like ecotone and stuff a little bit later, but I'm curious what brought you to the specific topic of this book. What made you want to write about the tall grass prairie and about the kind of forests of the 18th and 17th century Midwest and the environment of this region specifically?
Yeah. Well, I've reflected a lot about, you know, I get asked that quite a lot, and there part of it is the general answer that I gave you to your first question, is about, you know, what brought me to history in a bigger sense, because you know, that this book has kind of been brewing for a really long time. I've been learning this topic for ever since I, in a serious way, started learning about history, and I've always been interested in the indigenous history of the Midwest in particular. And then the environmental dimension of things has become a specific focus. I'm lucky to teach environmental history at U of I. I teach that class just about every year. You know, a lot of the historiography on the great works of American environmental history in particular are on either, you know, the West, the American West. Landscapes pretty remote from here in terms of sort of wild or agricultural landscapes, usually talking about places further west, or urban landscapes. And of course, we're in this agricultural heartland. So I have been kind of on the trail of thinking about local environmental history as in a serious way, especially for the last 12 years since I've been teaching at U of I, and trying to develop units of my courses that bring the lessons, you know, of, we're just trying to impart, like, oh, yeah, okay, what is this thing of environmental history? How does it change our understanding of the past to put non-human nature at the center of our story? And of course, the converse of that, how does it change our understanding of environmental issues, including local environmental issues, if we look at them historically? So anyway, I you know, local case studies have been a big part of my teaching practice for a long time. I've got a kind of a big one on agricultural drainage, which I may say more about over the course of this conversation, because it's become a big theme for me to learn about, and I'm learning more about it even as we speak. But then I've been reflecting on, like, the genesis of this topic very specifically, and where this book came from. And I have to say, it probably came more than anything else from running. I've been a distance runner, not a particularly good one at all, but it's been one of my hobbies for a long time. I went to college in Minnesota, went to a small college, Carleton College, and was on a cross country running team there. And, you know, you have the opportunity which became a great love of mine ever since, to run across this landscape, miles and miles. And, you know, I think the landscape of the Midwest, the agricultural landscape, it's impenetrable to many. It's a mystery to many. I mean, it's famously flat. It's monocultural. It's monotonous. It's plain. It can be kind of oppressive, you know, when it's not really beautiful and sublime. I mean, but anyway, it was a mystery to me too. And it was probably out, you know, exploring and just kind of just watching the miles go by on these long runs, where I started thinking about, well, okay, so what about the history of this landscape? What is this landscape all about? How did it come to be like this? And what has it been before? And of course, living here in Central Illinois, and you know, we're in this industrial farming epicenter, and it's just incredible. It's just such an amazing landscape to live in, you know, the histories that are here and that have been kind of concealed and erased, and that are not really at the top of consciousness, even for people who have spent their whole lives here. You know, I have a great appreciation for that. I'm kind of lucky, as my day job is to go and to think about this. So you know, like I kind of wanted to write about that in a serious way and kind of trace a story about colonialism in this place and about the period before pre-modernity in this place, before settler agriculture in this place, when it was a completely different landscape and of course full of people whose histories have been passively forgotten but also sometimes actively erased from the land, right? And so that it just became kind of a really fun mission. But yeah, it probably does come back to those miles. I can remember specific moments in my humble way, running across the landscape and thinking, you know what, this is a history book. I got to write this book.
Well, before we get into the story that you tell about this place and about this landscape in the book, I got one kind of final historiographical question that I want to get into a little bit. I'm wondering if you can explain the concept of vast early America. It's one of the sort of historiographical trends or themes that you are engaging with in the book. And to me, it's a really fascinating one. So can you explain that concept a bit and how your book and how the history that you tell, how it fits into that concept?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so I think this coinage comes from Karen Wolf, if I'm not mistaken, who was the director of the Omohundro Institute, which is our big research center for early American historians, academic historians. And it's really a wonderful, it's just a wonderful institution that brings together scholars who work on this period. And I think the concept of vast early America simply, acknowledged and acknowledges, what a lot of historians have been doing for a couple of generations at least, in this field or in these fields that kind of have coalesced around that concept. And that's simply decentering the idea of early America as just the precursor of the United States, right? Decentering national, historical trajectories in our consideration of what makes certain subjects in early American history relevant, right? I mean, of course, the trajectory of the coming of the United States is an important trajectory in the periods, from, let's say, 1492 to the 18th century, through the 18th century. But there are so many others, right? And if we decenter the trajectory of the United States and consider others, it turns out there are many, places and people and histories that fit much better in other contexts and for whom, like, their stories suddenly become relevant for very different reasons. So famously, a couple generations ago, people started doing a move like that around the Atlantic world and thinking about early American history as part of a much larger, right, context of encounter, of the growth of early capitalism, of the birth of racial slavery and the plantation and all these other themes. And of course, empire, the contest of empires over the territories of the Americas and, the Caribbean and et cetera. That's where I kind of first came into my historical career, because my first book was about empire, and I'd studied these French colonists in the mid-Mississippi Valley, who, again, like, they don't really belong. If the story of early America is simply precursor to the United States, right? Yeah, it makes we understand why you study Boston or Virginia or the Carolina, the British colonies, but these people didn't make sense really in that framework. They're kind of irrelevant. But with that decentering that the Atlantic world gave us, suddenly they kind of you know, the Atlantic World framework gave us, that suddenly they became really relevant with in much different kinds of stories, like, again, empire or that story about racial slavery, or, you know, most interesting to me, the encounters among diverse people in this process of early American history, right? When Europeans and Africans and indigenous people showed up and started interacting, in these different contexts. So anyway, that was the Atlantic World paradigm. And now I feel like the vast early America paradigm is giving us even a broader stage, right? For considering early American stories their relevance. And, you know, for me anymore, I think kind of unites a lot of these stories is a critical examination and a new examination of colonialism, right? And its legacies, how colonialism worked, what it did, you know, what we inherit from that, from those histories, which, you know, are still ongoing, of course, but which have in some cases their really important roots in this era. And again, this is where history is, I think, so relevant. I mean, colonialism is general, right? And it's even generic, right? Like, it happened in many times and in many places. So this book, People of the Ecotone, like I think a lot of these studies in vast early America, what it's trying to do is look at how colonialism happened in this very specific place, right? In this very specific context, to take that generic concept of colonialism and understand how it unfolded here in the Tallgrass Prairie region. And it turns out that place is a main actor in this story.
Well, with that said, then let's talk about this place a little bit, because as you're just saying, place is so much what this book is about. So let's get into the dirt, into the soil of the Tallgrass Prairie a bit. Can you describe the region that we're talking about, Illinois before it was Illinois? And this might be a good place for us to define a term a bit too. So what is this place? What makes it distinct, and what makes it an ecotone exactly?
Yeah, well, okay. So this book is based on a really pretty simplistic observation, which is that, before it became the monocultural heartland that it is today, the Corn Belt that it is today, where there are basically two species covering a great percentage of the land, here in much of the state of Illinois and most of Iowa and, you know, so many of the states around here. Before it became this monocultural heartland, this place was extremely diverse. And the reason it was diverse is because it is, on a continental scale, it's one of the most important transition zones in North America. It's the transition zone between, the broadly speaking, the woodlands, right, the temperate forests of the East and the Great Lakes in particular, on the one side, and on the other side, the grasslands of the West, right? So broadly speaking, you know, the Corn Belt is this divider. What became the Corn Belt is the divider. And at the heart of that division, between the woodlands and the grasslands, is this special ecology, which is the Tallgrass Prairie. So that's a kind of a, if you've got the short grass, arid west, grasslands of the West, it's not like that. You know, the Tallgrass Prairie, it's most of it is vanished, especially in the state of Illinois. I think there's just less than a single percentage of the land that was once under Tallgrass Prairie. It remains in that under that land cover, but it's It's especially ecology. And so for the purposes of this book, that division turns out to have a really important kind of role in history. And technically speaking, ecotone refers to these dividing places. Ecologists use that term to talk about, transitions between one kind of, plant assemblage and another. So between forests and wetlands, for instance, or between grasslands and forests. This happens to be one of the largest, biome scale transitions on the continent. And so what I wanted to do was to explore what that had to do with human history. And it turns out, as I try to describe in this book and I try to narrate in this book, it has a lot to do with how, kind of indigenous cultures use the land and sort of, fit into the land, created certain kinds of ecologies in an active way, almost in that sense, cultivated the land on a large scale. And then it has a lot to do with how colonialism interacted with those cultures and this place.
So one thing that environmental historians have really sort of landed upon as a group of scholars in the past, a couple generations of scholarship, is that environments are defined by dynamism. They're defined by change. I remember when I was coming up in grad school, my advisor had me read a whole bunch of work on things like chaos theory, for instance, to get me to stop thinking about environments as seeking some kind of stability, some kind of climax. And ecotones are great places to study this kind of environmental dynamism. They're places that are constantly shifting and changing. And one of the most important changes for the history of the region that you're talking about in this book, of this particular ecotone, isn't a human change at all, but is a non-human change. And so this might be a good place for us to bring in the bison into this story. Can you talk a bit about the history of the bison and particularly their role in this specific environment, in this place?
Yeah, well, this is a real important part of the story of how I came to write this book is to understand a kind of critical change that happened. It's not independent of people, because it turns out that people do have a role in this change, but definitely a change in the natural environment of the Midwest that starts. There's a long and sort of and kind of like fuzzy runway to this set of changes. So I don't really, it's hard to pinpoint a starting point, but there are climate changes in what we might call the medieval period of North America. So, right around 1000 AD or Common Era. And at first, there's this medieval warm period, a period of as the name suggests, kind of higher temperatures and a lot of moisture. And that affects the West in particular by the American West and the grasslands of the West, by just like creating a great boom of production, right, in those ecosystems. And along with that is a rise in the population, maybe to its highest ever extent in the great grazers of the American grasslands, bison, right? And so between 1,000, 1,200, 1,300 or so, we get this great boom in bison populations, which kind of continues in the next climate change, which is the onset of the so-called Little Ice Age, when temperatures actually, especially in the east coast of North America, get really cold. In Europe, there's a great spell of cold weather. In the West, the way that the Little Ice Age manifests is in drought. And so you have this big proliferation of bison out west. And as the grasslands of the far west start to, decline because of that drought, episode, this is over decades and even centuries of time, bison are pushed further and further to the east into these very humid grasslands, which are the tall grass prairies, right? Actually kind of marginal grasslands for grazers like bison for in the best of circumstances. But now this is not the best of circumstances. Some bison are moving east to, you know, escape these drought conditions. And so for the first time, or I shouldn't probably say it like that, but it is a novel moment around the same time as Europeans are showing up in North America, let's say 1500. Some of these herds of bison are moving as far east as they maybe ever went. Now there are bison, don't get me wrong about this. There are bison all over North America. You know, I think in every state besides Delaware, poor Delaware, I guess is the only state, east of the Mississippi that where archaeologists have not found remains of bison. There are bison all over the place, but they tend to be small, you know, even loners, you know, one or two, not huge herds, but what makes this moment in the 1500s distinctive is that there are herds of bison, hundreds, maybe even thousands, in a single herd moving, you know, again, across the Mississippi River and into this landscape, of the Tallgrass Prairie, where they are met by people who are very happy to try to make that landscape as hospitable for them as they can, which they do by burning it, by cultivating it, you know, so to speak. It's really a form of a kind of animal husbandry as they try to maximize the amount suitable grazing land that they could for these bison herds, because it is such an opportunity to have these animal partners here in this grassland. So that's an event. That's a historical event, you know, again, and it happens at this interesting moment in human history. The city state or chiefdom of Cahokia, which is a assemblage of maybe 20 to 30,000 people living in the mid-Mississippi Valley, from about 1000 AD through 1250, when that city-state kind of empties out. In the wake of that, and at a time when maybe agriculture is a little bit harder, it's, you know, a little bit less secure because of the droughty conditions, bison are a huge opportunity for these prairie inhabitants, some of whom are coming, actually moving to the east, moving from the east to the west, out of the Great Lakes, and those are the people that are the protagonists of my story. Many of those people who are, you know, Algonquian speakers, we can probably call them proto-Illinois speakers, the ancestors of the Illinois speakers and the Meskwaki, and some other Algonquian tribes. They move into places like the Illinois River Valley, the Wabash River Valley, from the east, right as this bison opportunity is taking off. And that is a major moment that I tried to write about, you know, kind of as a shift, as a rupture in the history of this region.
And so much of this book is about the relationship between these people and not just this place, but bison in particular. And I think my favorite chapter of the book was the one where you talk a lot about non-equestrian bison hunting. I feel like for a lot of people, even historians, when they imagine bison hunting native societies, they imagine people on horseback, right? Kind of post late 17th century equestrian nomads. And you talk a lot about people that hunted bison on foot, that ran after bison, kind of relating to the kind of inroad that you made into this story about your own running across these prairies. So can you explain a bit the relationship between the people of the prairie, of the ecotone region that they had with this place and with the bison in particular, and their hunting and bison processing practices generally?
Well, yeah, I mean, so this rupture, the arrival of bison and the arrival of these groups like the Illinois and the Meskwaki in this moment, I mean, it does create this great, let's say, opportunity for a new kind of economy. And at a time when it was pretty valuable to be able to exploit these grasslands in a new way. But again, as you point out, this is a little different from the kind of bison culture that we often have in our imaginations, because it is not equestrian bison hunting, but rather hunting on foot. And not only that, if we do have an image of what pedestrian bison hunting was all about, typically what we envision is this practice, which was common, you know, places like Montana and other places in the period, you know, before and alongside of equestrian bison hunting, where teams of runners would corral bison to a particular geographical feature, usually involving a cliff, right, or a jump or a trap, where the animals would be chased, you know, in some cases even over a cliff, and then they could be pretty easily killed if they didn't die in falling off that cliff. Of course, in central Illinois, if you've ever been here, we don't have any cliffs, and quite the contrary. This is one of the flattest landscapes in all of North America, thanks to the glaciation of, you know, 2.5 million years ago down to more recently, you know, I think the end of the last glaciers is 11,000 years ago or so. You know, so a super flat landscape, no opportunity to chase the animals off of a cliff or a jump. So it's a very different and distinctive kind of bison hunting that takes shape here. And, you know, Europeans who showed up in the late 1600s were understandably really fascinated by this. So they wrote a lot of accounts of how Indians did it. And they did it through large groups. They did it through cooperation. They did it through, you know, a great deal of coordination and kind of know-how, but also a ton of running. Like, you started way back, you know, in teams, coordinated teams, and, you know, began to walk so that the animals on, you know, you'd have a group on either flank of a herd of, let's say, a few hundred animals, and you'd want, you know, you don't want to chase them away to a place where the bison will run, they'll skedaddle. So you got to be very careful. So they were very masterful at how they were able to kind of coordinate together and, of course, move across the land quickly and strategically to get them to a place. And this is also very important, where the animals, I mean, once you kill them, like, it's going to be tough to move them, right? So, because a bison bull is 2,000 pounds, if not more. So if you kill it out in the middle of nowhere, it's kind of useless, right? You got to get it to a place where it's actually going to be useful, and then you can exploit all the calories that animal represents and all the other things that it represents in terms of material for technology and et cetera. But again, just think about the know-how that goes into that, right? And the embodied physical and biophysical relationships that people have with the, not just the animal, but the process of exploiting the animal, right? And that, in this book, I tried to describe and I tried to imagine, because of course a lot of it has to be a little bit speculative, but just how many imperatives that created and how much that shaped how people lived, down to you know, things that we would oftentimes think of as very much cultural, right? You know, relationships between families, relationships within families, and other features of culture that probably were strongly shaped. I don't want to say determined, but strongly shaped by the requirements of this economy. And you know, and then it continues from there. I mean, there is killing the animals, there is the actual hunt, but then from there come other requirements and imperatives and, you know, kind of ways in which working with bison, living with bison, utilizing bison also shapes aspects of life. And this becomes especially true as the people entered a proto-capitalist market in the first part of the bison to be commodified in this period is the hide.
So let's zoom out a little bit and take a regional look here. By the time we get to the kind of mid to late 17th century, you have new people that are arriving from the east, pushing west into the center of North America. And historians have often described changes like this as really being driven by colonialism, right? By Europeans and by violence induced by settler colonialism kind of on the East Coast pushing westward. But you try to tell the story from a different perspective. You tell the story a little bit differently. So how were the people of the Ecotone, how were they important historical actors themselves during this era in the 17th century of the beaver trade and the kind of height of European colonialism in the 17th century?
Well, so as I said, first of all, they're moving out and kind of occupying and taking control of this region, for reasons at first that have nothing to do at all, probably, with colonialism, but rather with the kind of, opportunity I think that the offerings, the possibilities of this lifeway. So even before colonialism gets going in any way, and of course, even as it gets going, it's really important to remember that for the mid-continent in the 17th and 18th century, what colonialism looks like oftentimes is just a very few people, right? I mean, this is not settler colonialism in that kind of mode that takes place out in on the East Coast. So we're talking about sojourners, traders, missionaries. This remains very much an indigenous world driven by indigenous logics. And, you asked earlier about the nature of the ecotone as a biological reality, the division between the woodlands and the grasslands. That maps on, interestingly, to kind of some cultural transitions as well in Native North America in this period. That is, kind of woodlands people of the Great Lakes, many of whom were speakers of Iroquoian and Algonquian languages, were broadly different, broadly distinguished from cultures of the West, of the grasslands, who many of whom spoke Siouan and Caddoan languages. And, one thing that made this landscape special, in addition to the kind of ecological affordances of bison hunting, is that it was this important kind of cultural borderland as well. So moving here, it created opportunities for the people that I write about, like the Illinois and the Meskwaki, beyond just the ecological ones, and extending to sort of, we could even say, like strategic, kind of political, maybe, kinds of advantages and opportunities. That's because those cultural divisions, the divisions or separations between the Algonquian and the Iroquoian speakers of the woodlands and those of the grasslands, that the people, those divisions had kind of, to be very blunt about it, there were very few kind of kinship connections across this transition zone, which turned out to have important implications for one of the things that underlay a lot of kind of military strategy inside of these native nations and cultures at this time, that involved a kind of imperative of warfare
around kinship replacement. So like when you lost a family member in battle, oftentimes there was an imperative or at least an incentive, a kind of motivation to try to bring somebody else in replacement of that loss. Inside of the Great Lakes world, that was difficult to do because kinship networks were very strong among the peoples of the Great Lakes. But out in the West, where people, speaking different languages, belonging to very different kinship lineages, who could supply that that need, that imperative. And people in the Ecotone region, for, reasons occasioned, of course, and then certainly exacerbated by colonialism, but not really initially created by colonialism, they became sort of specialists in this process of supplying some of these captives to the Great Lakes world. And you can kind of imagine that I try to write in detail in this book about how that accelerated a certain kind of violence in the region. That again, it's absolutely tied to colonialism, but it has its own kind of indigenous logic to it as well. So anyway, it all gets going with these migrations to the West by some of these Algonquians, their adoption of bison hunting, and then their kind of the stand that they make inside of this transition zone that contains these particular strategic opportunities.
Well, and then that's the next question that I wanted to ask is this sort of uptick in violence that occurs as a result, because by the time you get to the early 18th century, which is about when you kind of wrap up the story that you're telling, the prairies at the center of North America are becoming an increasingly violent place. And once again, you have environmental factors, especially animals like bison, but also beaver as well, that are really at the center of the story of why this is happening. So how did animals and how are environmental changes, how are they also driving warfare and violence in this area, in this place?
Well, one thing that I learned in writing this book that I sort of knew, but it became much more clearly important in my understanding of history and what happened in the colonial era in the Midwest. One fact is that explorers from France, including very famously Robert La Salle, who is, of course, the explorer who went down in the 1670s and 1680s, went down the Mississippi River for the first time, and was a real ambitious, kind of enterprising colonist who wanted to try to exploit and make a fortune in trade in North America. And what he had his eye on during a period when everybody was going gaga about the beaver trade, right? Because beaver became the biggest the biggest commodity for Canada for much of the 17th century. And indigenous people, hunted and traded that commodity to Europeans, and that became a real engine of history. But La Salle had his eye not on beaver, but on bison. And he thought that bison would soon eclipse the value of the entire beaver trade, particularly because of their hides. He thought that their hides were potentially super valuable for some specific market needs in France related to the military. And he was sure that if he could get a monopoly on bison skins, then he could make a fortune. And so he did, and he got that monopoly initially. Then he died, but some others took over, and they set up what was the kind of like realization of their dream. They set up a tannery where they hoped that they could, like, these are massive hides, of course, bison hides. So you don't want to send them home in rawhide. You want to get them as finished as you can. So put a tannery in the middle of the region where the bison are plentiful, and you can kind of make a good business that way. So some traders started to do that. Of course, to make a European style tannery out in the middle of North America at that time was really not realistic. So what they were really relying on was indigenous labor to produce these hides. And that turns out to be a really important part of the story, because in all of the bison economy, and as fascinating as it was from the running and the hunting and all the know-how and the fascinating kind of community dynamics and the division of labor, the bottleneck of it all was in processing the leather, because it was super labor intensive. The technique was brain tanning, and that involved, you know, I write about it in the book. I won't go into it now, but it's a lot of work. I mean, it's work. Ultimately, it comes down to labor. And so to the question about the relationship between, you know, Indians kind of ambitiously entered this marketplace that was set up initially by LaSalle and his successors. And they supplied lots and lots of these hides. But to do that, they needed to also rely on, you know, sources of labor and solutions to a kind of labor problem, which I describe in the book. And that in turn produces or exacerbates some patterns of violence that you see all over the Great Lakes and North America at this period. You know, I mean, the introduction of guns, the introduction of European disease, the introduction of like competition among people trying to get access to these marketplaces, those things did what they did. But then the bison economy itself and the specific requirements, labor requirements, of producing bison interacted with, right, all of those other factors in a really kind of specific way that escalated that violence. And again, so like, you really can't understand why disease and why guns and why those other factors, right, were so consequential and destructive inside of these villages, unless you also understand that they were producing bison hides, and particularly that, you know, relying on, as much labor as they could get, right, to produce additional hides. The best way to get that labor, it turns out, were in these violent raids, these raids to the west. Again, they were perfectly positioned for this inside of the ecotone, this kind of cultural borderland. So it really is a kind of, on the one hand, a rise to power, and on the other hand, you can kind of see it spiraling pretty quickly into ever greater violence.
So you end this story in the kind of middle decades of the 18th century. So I'm curious why you chose to wrap the story up there, and then what comes next? I mean, there's centuries of history, of course, still to come after this book comes to a close, and we, you know, don't have time to go over everything that happens, of course. But how does this story that you tell end, and then what happens afterwards? How does the ecotone change even more so from this very diverse and dynamic landscape into one that's defined so much today by its sameness and by its kind of ecological monoculture?
Yeah. Well, the story that I told in this book ends kind of in the mid 18th century, in part because I structured the book around trying to explain what were these really consequential but sometimes hard to understand indigenous conflicts of this period, which the French called the Fox Wars. And they had a climactic moment in the 1730s, excuse me, not far from here, that again, I kind of use this narrative of, like, you know, how the bison economy is interacting with the introduction of disease and the introduction of guns and the, you know, arrival of a capitalist market or proto-capitalist market, and how this kind of intensifies these raids and et cetera, how all of that kind of plays into the coming of the Fox Wars. That's the story I tried to tell in this book, and it comes to this kind of natural climax in the 1730s. This story doesn't end, except in so far as, you know, in terms of the bison economy, and you know, I said earlier that LaSalle was convinced that this was going to be a major commodity. Well, it didn't pan out, right? And it didn't work the way he said it would. And bison really didn't sort of remain such a glimmer in the eye of the Europeans. Of course, it came back. Like, the bison economy of the 19th century is also super consequential in American history. But that's, you know, major use of bison leather at that time, of course, is in, like, belts for factories, for industrial equipment. So it's a totally different trade. But by the mid 18th century, the French have kind of lost some interest in bison. And if they still have interest in the bison trade, they're not thinking about the mid Mississippi Valley anymore, because they know that the larger concentration of bison, of course, is much further west, as they get out, you know, into the Missouri River and, you know, some of the short grass plains environment, where the bison herds are not 100, 200, 300 animals, but, you know, thousands and thousands of animals. That's where that opportunity is, and they know that. So the Illinois, the Meskwaki, they're kind of left in the lurch. They're kind of, and that's, I think that's one of the interesting parts of the rise and fall story that's involved here, is that, you know, they made a lot of choices for these opportunities, but then the opportunity kind of quickly disappeared. So that kind of explains the trajectory of the book. I mean, the question of what happens next, I mean, interestingly, the Midwest remains a kind of animal ecology for a longer time than we usually think. You know, I live in Champaign. The oldest building in Champaign, I believe this is true, is now the location of our Champaign County Historical Society. And it's famously got this picture, and I have this recreated in the book. There's a picture of it in the book. It famously got a sign on it that says Cattle Bank. And that's important. I mean, that, first of all, the building looks like it ought to be out in Texas or Nebraska or something. Cattle Bank, what's that doing here? Shouldn't it be Corn Bank? But the answer to that question is, like, no. In the 19th century, it was hard to grow corn here. In fact, it was prohibitive to grow corn here. And many settler agriculturalists who arrived here first were ranchers and not doing row crops. That didn't come later, or that didn't come until later, when they did the massive landscape engineering project that made row crop agriculture possible in this region, which is drainage. They had to drain out the land. And until then, this remained kind of cattle economy, you know, cattle land in large measure. So there is actually some interesting continuity that I discovered, you know, between, like, okay, well, if we can't intensively farm up on the upland prairie until it gets plowed and until it gets drained, then you know, the best way to exploit that energy source is just the same way that the Illinois and the Meskwaki were doing before, which is, you know, basically ranging animals up there and exploiting them rather than row crops. So there is some interesting continuity. But, you know, in terms of sort of what comes next, you know, the end of the 18th century, by that time, the Indians had lost a lot of power, out of these cycles of violence and, the destruction that was brought by the Fox Wars. And so, you know, that's another, you know, that is a discontinuity for sure, because settler colonialism begins in the mid-18th century and more French people and eventually, you know, British and American people show up, and the shift is pretty quick to settler hegemony here. And the period of Indian power, I mean, particularly this great center of power that the place was, that gets eclipsed pretty quick.
So as we begin to wrap up here, there's a question that I always like to present to my guests as sort of a summary type question. And so I'm going to ask you to put yourself in the shoes of someone who has read your book and is thinking back to, is remembering this book, say a year on from now or 5 years on from now. What would you hope that person remembers or takes away from this book a few years on down the line?
Well, I really hope, I mean, I, without sounding simplistic, I really hope that this book convinces the reader that this was a really important place, important location in early America, that there were some really consequential things going on here. And secondly, the reason why those really consequential things were happening here is because of what was here, right? That this was the place itself. Now, it wasn't just a setting for important history. It's one of the very consequential, very distinctive environments of early America. And so I hope the takeaway is simply to kind of remember what makes this place distinctive and to then understand a story of why it was important.
I think this book serves as a good way for understanding how all places are distinctive. And like you said, that also sounds very simplistic, but you know, if you can weave this kind of rich and nuanced story out of a place that most people refer to disparagingly as like flyover country, right? Then what other stories are we missing about places as well?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And also, again, to that point that I was trying to make earlier about colonialism, like, you know, there are lots of, there's a way in which we can think about a category like colonialism in very general terms, very generic terms, and think about like, this is what it is. But on the ground in a specific location, you see how it actually unfolded. And here it unfolded in relationship, in very complicated chains of causation between, you know, like these non-human geographical features, non-human animal actors, the requirements of their metabolism, right? Fire that served those, the ecology on which they depended, you know, the cultural, patterns that hunting bison incentivized, I guess, and then how that interacted in turn with, say, something like a disease epidemic because people were living in large villages. All to say, right? I mean, it's like the general of colonialism now becomes extremely specific in this setting.
And then to close us out here, Bob, I always like to get a preview when I can of what my guests are working on next. Historians always have a few different plates spinning at any one time. And I know this book has not been out for very long, but I'm curious if you have any other projects or any other next books that you've been working on. What have you been working on in the meantime?
Yeah, thanks. No, I kind of foreshadowed it a little bit or revealed a little bit. I'm currently working on a teaching project that I don't know if it's going to turn into a research project or writing project, but I'm really excited to learn more about this this environmental history of landscape engineering and especially wetlands drainage in our region. I think it is one of the most consequential chapters of landscape change in North America. Of course, it's connected with a lot of issues that we're pretty aware of, like, pollution of the Gulf of Mexico that comes a lot in large measure from ag chemicals upstream in states like Illinois and Iowa and et cetera. And, you know, I think that's a hidden history too. I mean, it's very almost literally hidden because the infrastructure that accomplished wetlands drainage around here is literally buried in the ground. But I think it's every bit as consequential a chapter of environmental history as more kind of famous episodes of land reclamation in the West with irrigation and dam building and all that kind of stuff. So I'm looking down that particular rabbit hole at the moment, and we'll see where that goes.
Dr. Robert Morrissey is professor of history at the University of Illinois, and his new book is People of the Ecotone: Environment and Indigenous Power at the Center of Early America, which came out with the University of Washington Press in 2022, and this past October in 2023 won the Hal Rothman Prize from the Western History Association. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your work with me today, Bob.
Yeah, thanks so much, Stephen. Appreciate it.